Good morning. I'm Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of Senator Rockefeller and our board of directors, I want to welcome you to a program that looks at one of the key components in the machinery laid out in the health reform law, that is health insurance exchanges. Now, these are places where the idea is to offer consumers and small businesses a transparent market where they're going to be able to shop among affordable coverage options, and it'll be a place where the exchange can help determine the individual's eligibility for various subsidies that are available under the law. They're scheduled to be operational in time to start taking I'm not used to these morning programs. In time to start actually covering people in January of 2014. There are a lot of moving parts that have to be put in place for that to happen. Now, it's been almost 2.5 years since the law was enacted, but a lot of states have been reluctant to invest a whole lot of time and resources into establishing these exchanges, given the continuing controversy over the law's merit, even its constitutionality. So, as you'll hear, there's a lot of work to be done if consumers are going to be able to use these marketplaces to choose the insurance that's right for them. And we're hoping to gauge that progress this morning, the progress that both federal and state governments are making on setting up these exchanges. And we're going to look at the major challenges facing everybody involved in both setting them up and operating the exchanges. We're pleased to have as a partner today the Commonwealth Fund, which has done and commissioned a lot of analytical work on exchanges as an important component of a high-performance health system. I want you to note in your packets a brand-new paper by Sarah Rosenbaum and her colleagues that Commonwealth commissioned on the first generation of state exchange laws as a good example. And we're even more pleased to have as the co-moderator and active participant in today's discussion, Sarah Collins, an economist by training and the vice president for affordable health insurance at the fund. Sarah?
Thank you, Ed. And thank you to the panelists for joining us today. As Ed mentioned, the state exchanges are, are really new private insurance marketplaces. They are the centerpiece, truly, of the Affordable Care Act's coverage provisions. They'll be the central place where people will go for health insurance if they don't have an offer of affordable coverage through a job. People will gain access to an array of insurance options, private plans, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program. States may establish their own exchanges, or HHS will play a more active role in the state setting up exchanges. In order to establish exchanges, states have to give themselves the legal authority to do so. So on this map, which is now an interactive tool on the Commonwealth Fund's website, 14 states and the District of Columbia in darker blue on the map either have signed legislation in place or executive orders by their governors that have established exchanges. The lighter blue states on the map are a mixture of states with histories of legislation over the past 2 years that's been introduced or passed, or active initiatives by their governors. The eight states in white have decided not to establish exchanges. As Ed mentioned in your packet, there's a new Commonwealth Fund brief by Sarah Rosenbaum and her colleagues that compares the provisions of the state exchange laws as right now. A key finding of the research is that while much of the details are yet to be worked out by the exchanges themselves, really, all of them have been created as public, public accountable entities with policy and market-shaping power. Many states that don't have legislation in place have federal grants to design their exchanges. About 34 states in the District of Columbia have received about $830 million in grants. In 2014, when both the federal and state exchanges are operational, people without an offer of employer coverage or with public insurance coverage will have a choice of private so-called qualified health plans sold through the exchanges that will offer a comprehensive set of benefits, also known as the essential health benefit package. People with incomes between 100% and 400% of poverty, that's about $23,000 to $92,000 for a family of four, are eligible for tax credits that will cap their premium costs as a share of their incomes. In the wake of the Supreme Court decision, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that about 29 to 30 million people will become newly covered under the law by 2020. This is about 3 million fewer than CBO estimated in its prior estimates in March. About 11 million people will be newly covered through Medicaid. This is down from 17 million in their prior estimates. About 25 million people are estimated to be covered through the exchanges. This is about 3 million more than were estimated to be covered previously before the Supreme Court decision. So what's behind the change in the estimates? The Supreme Court decision, as everyone knows, changed the Medicaid expansion in the law such that states are permitted but are not required to expand their Medicaid programs to adults earning up to 133% of the poverty level. The decision, however, leaves intact the substantial federal financing for the expansion, 100% in the first 3 years, and phasing down to 90% by 2020. In states that participate in the expansion, people earning between 100 and 133% of poverty are eligible for Medicaid, but people in states that don't expand would be eligible for the premium tax credits within that income range. But those plans are more expensive to enrollees, and so the CBO estimates that there would be lower take-up than there would be in the Medicaid expansion as a result. Under the law, people with incomes under 100% of poverty are not generally eligible for the tax credits. It was assumed that nearly everyone in that income range would be covered through the Medicaid expansion. Nationally, nearly half of adults, about 15 million people with incomes under 100% of poverty are uninsured. The numbers are even higher in some states that have indicated they won't move forward, about 1.9 million people uninsured in that income range in Texas, for example. In arriving at this latest estimate, CBO makes assumptions about incentives facing states in deciding whether to participate and the numbers of people newly eligible who might face delays in gaining coverage. But there is a huge amount of uncertainty, clearly, about what the final outcome will be. The panel today is going to take up some of the key implementation issues for the exchanges, particularly in the wake of the Supreme Court decision. Given that open enrollment begins in October 2013, what are the next steps for state and federal governments to meet that deadline? And what are the implications of the decision, particularly as regards coverage of lower-income families? What are federal and state policy options if state participation in the Medicaid expansion is delayed? And with that, I'll turn this back over to Ed.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Just a couple of quick logistical items. In your packets, there's a lot of good background information, including biographical information of all of our speakers. There are copies of the PowerPoint presentations that we had on hand in time to reproduce, and we'll have Krista Drobeck's presentation on our website, allhealth.org, as soon as we get back. Everything is listed on a one-page materials sheet that has a lot of background material that we didn't kill trees to put into your hands in hard copy, but are nonetheless useful in this discussion. There's a webcast available on Monday through the good offices of the Kaiser Family Foundation on their website, kff.org, or the Alliances. We'll have a transcript on our website in about a week. We invite you to use the green question cards at the appropriate time in the program, and there's a blue evaluation form that we would desperately like you to fill out and give us some feedback and suggestions on not only how to make programs better, but what to do programs on. We can use your input on that very important question. So let's get to the program without further delay. We're going to start. We've got a great panel for you. We're going to start with Tim Jost. Professor Jost teaches health law, among other things, at Washington and Lee University Law School. In fact, he wrote the most prominent case book used in teaching health law across the country. He's a consumer representative on the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. He's a veteran of a number of Commonwealth Alliance panels, and we're very glad to welcome you back. Tim?
Thank you very much. When the Affordable Care Act was passed 28 months ago, many wondered why its most important reforms were delayed for almost 4 months. Today, a little over a year before the exchanges will start signing up their first enrollees, it seems like 2014 is coming far too soon. HHS, the IRS, and the Labor Department have released hundreds of pages of regulations and guidance since March of 2010, when the ACA was signed into law. Most were issued on time and implemented without serious problems, although the pace of implementation has slowed least recently. On January 1st, 2014, most of the remaining ACA reforms are supposed to go into effect. First, an American Health Benefits Exchange must be in place in every state, including a SHOP small business exchange. Second, the ACA underwriting reforms, which I think Brian will talk more about, must be in effect. Third, the risk adjustment, reinsurance, and risk corridor programs must be up and running. Fourth, the individual and employer responsibility programs must be in place. Fifth, premium tax credits and cost-sharing reduction payments must be available to assist middle-income Americans purchase health insurance. And finally, Medicaid must be expanded to all individuals below age 65 with incomes below 138% of the poverty level in those states that choose to participate. Most important among these reforms are the exchanges, the gateway to all the other reforms. The ACA asks the states to establish exchanges, but allows also the possibility of federal exchanges for states that do not decide to proceed with establishing their own exchanges. And in particular, in states that are determined on January 1st, 2013, to be unlikely to have an exchange in place by January 1st, 2014. The final rule, however, on exchanges sets forth a somewhat more complicated framework. First, it recognizes pure state exchanges, although even these state exchanges can cede certain functions to the federal government. Second, there are partnership exchanges in which a state agrees to carry out plan management or consumer assistance functions or both and leaves other functions to the federal government. Finally, there are federally facilitated exchanges, but even in these, states can take on certain functions. States must notify HHS by November 16th of this year, 8 business days after the election, which of these options they prefer to pursue. But the exchange rules recognize even further flexibility. State exchanges can be conditionally approved in 2013 if they are likely but not certain to be operational by 2014. A state that begins with a federally facilitated exchange can transition to a full state exchange over a 12-month period, or vice versa. Exchange establishment funding will continue to be available till the end of 2014 for lagging states and can be spent for up to 3 years thereafter. While 2014 is the target date for the reforms, in fact, the exchanges must be underway well before that date. They must open for enrollment in October of 2013. They must, therefore, have certified qualified health plans before that date. In turn, insurers must have designed and priced their exchange plans and filed forms and rates with state regulators before QHP certification. If you work backwards from October of 2013, you get almost to the present. Obviously, states and insurers need a lot more information very soon. And here I'd suggest that you look at the gray handout rather than trying to read the slides, because there's a lot of information here which you won't absorb now but hopefully can use later. HHS has issued final rules on the individual and SHOP exchanges, qualified health plans and qualified employers, the 3R programs, Medicaid eligibility under the ACA, and as of last week, on data collection to support essential health benefits and recognition of QHP accreditation programs. The IRS has issued final rules on premium tax credits, although those rules contain significant gaps. And for those of you who don't know, every time a new rule comes out or guidance, I blog about it on the Health Affairs blog. So if you don't want to read a 100-page or a 300-page regulation, that will give you a quicker intro. HHS has also issued guidance on a number of topics, including the federal exchange, essential health benefits, actuarial value, and exchange in Medicaid IT systems, as well as frequently asked questions on a variety of subjects and a draft blueprint for state and partnership exchanges. HHS has also provided additional guidance to the state as it states as it has negotiated establishment grants. On some issues, such as essential health benefits, guidance will not suffice and further regulatory action is necessary. On other topics, such as the federally facilitated exchange, HHS has no legal obligation to proceed through regulation and may simply proceed through guidance. A number of 2014 requirements of the ACA are, from my reading of the statute, self-executing. No rule is necessary to implement them. These, among others, include the prohibition on annual limits post-2014, the pre-existing condition exclusion ban, guaranteed renewability, and the prohibition against discrimination based on health status. For other 2014 reforms, however, rules will be needed that are not yet issued, including requirements for quality reporting by plans, the limits on rating factors that can be considered in the individual and small group market, guaranteed availability, the basic health plan, and individual employer responsibility provisions. I'm trusting Mike's going to give us an update on all of these later on in the program. The agencies have already signaled their intent to delay full implementation of some of these provisions, such as the exchange quality provisions, a bit longer, and we may perhaps have a little breathing space left yet before some of these provisions, like the employer and individual responsibility provisions, need to be in place. On the other hand, some issues, such as risk pooling or underwriting requirements, we need decisions very soon. Making major policy decisions in the highly charged political atmosphere that will exist between now and the election will be difficult, but some decisions simply cannot wait if we're going to get to the January 1, 2014 date. States that have not yet taken executive or legislative action to establish an exchange have probably missed the boat for creating a state exchange. Time will also be tight for creating partnership exchanges. I would expect at this point that we will end up with a federally facilitated exchange initially in most states. On the other hand, if President Obama is reelected, I expect that federally facilitated exchanges will be up and running and capable of fulfilling basic exchange functions. And I also expect that most states will transition to a state exchange, with partnership status being a potential way station. There will certainly be glitches along the way, as there are in the implementation of most major changes in the public and private sector. But I remain hopeful that in the near future, the promises of extending health insurance coverage to millions of middle-income Americans will in fact be fulfilled.
Thank you, Tim. Next, we're going to turn to Brian Webb, who's also been on our dais before. He's the manager of health policy and legislation for the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. Brian's also served as a health policy advisor to former House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Bill Thomas, and in senior positions at what's now the Federation of American Hospitals and at the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. Wide background. We're very pleased to welcome you back to the program. Brian?
Thank you very much. Before I get too far along here, one of the questions we always get is the why question. Why do we have to have these exchanges up and running by 2014? Can't we just put that off a year or so? Can't we just string it out a while? And the problem is the rest of the law. We have to remember the exchange is not operating in a vacuum here. The reality is the individual mandate, we have been told, is unconstitutional. It will go into effect. That will start January 1st, 2014. People have to have coverage, have to have qualified coverage in order to meet that mandate. Well, to help those, especially lower income persons under 400% of poverty, There are subsidies available. But in the individual market, the only way you can get the subsidy is to purchase where? Through the exchange. So you have to have an exchange up and running, selling products prior to January 1st, 2014. They've suggested October 2013, selling qualified products so people can have those products in their hands as of January 1st, 2014, so they can then meet the requirements of the law. So there isn't really a lot of wiggle room here unless somebody wants to go back and change the law. Do I have a hands? I know there's some, but unless they can do that, people are going to get caught in a bind. So we need these exchanges up and running, and frankly, if the states don't do it, the feds will have to. That is not an option that a lot of people want. We love the federal government, right? They do a fantastic job. But this is a task that would be massive for the federal government. So just speaking for the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, we hope the states will play a major role in getting these things up and running and making sure that everybody gets the protections. Now, there's a lot of work to do. You can't see this, but it's on your paper. We've gone through many things, but you see that 2014... exchanges isn't the only thing going to happen. So you have to keep that in mind. States are going to have to do a lot of work to try to get ready for 2014. It's not just exchanges. In fact, much of it has to do with the market reforms. I know that exchanges are the big, beautiful building out there that everybody wants to point to and say, isn't that wonderful, and it's going to change everything. The reality is the thing that will change insurance for most people are the market reforms, especially in the individual market. For the first time in most states, people will be able to get coverage, even if they have a pre-existing condition. They can get coverage immediately. They will not be rated based on their health status. They will not be able to be put into a small little book of business, but will have to be shared across the entire book of business. These are major reforms that will impact rates and will impact access to coverage in every state. These are important reforms, and we have to get ready for these, not just in the exchange, but outside the exchange as well. And the reality is, if the states do not get ready for this, then they lose the ability to regulate. We must understand, we have some states who will sit there and say, well, I'm not doing anything. Well, they may get their wish and not be able to do anything in their marketplaces. There's language in the legislation that says nothing in this title shall be construed to preempt any state law that does not prevent the application of the revision of this title. What that means is if you have a state law that prevents the application of the federal law, then it is thereby preempted. So if you as a state sit there and say, well, I'm not going to do guarantee issue in my individual market. I'm not going to do the rating reform. I'm going to approve plans that don't have the essential health benefit package. I'm going to approve plans that have annual limits. I'm going to approve plans that have lifetime limits. The reality is your laws in your state will be preempted, and it will be up to the federal government. Mike Hash personally will have to come in and approve all rates and forms in your state. Basically, the state will be relegated to the position they have with Medicare Advantage, where they do licensing and solvency, and that's it. Whose choice is that? That is the state choice. But that's the reality. That's why states have to start getting ready. And you have many options. Again, that's the whole marketplace. We have to start getting ready for essential health benefits. Now, the federal government has said we will allow the state to choose the essential health benefit from a list of possible options. I know you've heard this many times. The three largest small group, three largest federal employee plans, three largest state employee plans, the largest HMO. You choose. Now, we need the final regs, Mike. Proposed regs, anything. But states should be working on that. We know what the first quarter of this year looked like, and we have until September 30th, 2012, for a state to choose what that benchmark plan is that people have to sell inside and outside the exchange. Now, that's become a soft deadline. But I'll tell you, the insurance companies are very nervous about this being a soft deadline because they need to know what the products are that they're going to have to sell. So we need to know what these products are. States have an opportunity to step in and be part of that process of choosing that benchmark, what has to be offered. We also have to start being prepared to do this concept of actuarial value. We don't do this a lot, if any. We have to be able to look at these plans and see if the cost-sharing structure that they have for those essential benefits meet these bronze, silver, gold, platinum, catastrophic limits. So states have to be prepared to do that. Again, if the federal government, if the state government doesn't do it, it will be up to the federal government to do it. If the states are approving plans that don't meet those standards, then the feds will have to step in. So states have to be prepared for that. They also have a choice whether they want to run the reinsurance program. That's that three-year program. Billions of dollars nationwide are going to be shifted from the individual small group, large group, self-insured marketplace down into the individual market. The state has to choose. Do I want to be part and be making the decisions about who in the individual market gets that windfall or appropriate amount of money, depending on how you look at it? So who's going to decide? If the state doesn't do it, the feds will. Risk corridors. If the state, and only if the state is doing the state exchange, then the state can choose to do the risk adjustment. Otherwise, we're going to be using the federal risk adjustment program. Risk corridors, that's a federal program. We don't like to talk about it. We think it's kind of interesting. Now, when we come to exchanges, states do have options, and we appreciate this. And I have to say, as states, we're always pushing for state flexibility, state flexibility, state flexibility. We're getting that through these regulations, and we got this in this law. States have the choices here. Now, there are minimum standards, but states have a lot of flexibility. A state can say, I want a federally facilitated exchange. I don't want to do this. But what that means is the federal government is choosing how it runs. Now, initially, they've said, we'll let everybody in. Any qualified health plans, they can come in and they can sell. There's no guarantee in the future that's the way it's going to be. We don't know what the future federal facilitated exchange is going to do, how it's going to operate, how it's going to choose people. They've said, oh, we're going to use state network adequacy rules. We're going to use state marketing rules generally. Again, if they're running it, though, they still have the opportunity to make those decisions. So that is a question. Do you as a state want the federal government making those decisions and running the federally facilitated exchange? Now, the state can still do the Medicaid eligibility, but you're basically giving the rest over to the federal government. Now, I would warn, if a state says, I want to do federal facility change, we are hopeful that states at least will help the feds, telling them who's licensed, who's solvent, who's a qualified health plan that has and is actually approving plans that can be sold on the exchange. We have to have some coordination. They recognize that. We recognize that. We can do a step up, though, and do partnership where the state government is actually for the federally facilitated exchange deciding who the qualified health plans are. They're certifying them. They're saying, we're going to look at their rates, we're going to look at their forms, we're going to make sure they have all the benefits, we're going to do that, and then tell the federal government that these are approved. We're going to check the network adequacy, we're going to check the marketing, we're going to do all of that. That's an option where the state is a good, solid partner with the federal government, and therefore has more say in how these plans are regulated. And finally, a state, of course, can do a state exchange, where they have total control about how these things run, as long as they're meeting the minimum standards in the federal law. Now, what I didn't put on here is the states also at the same time they're deciding how the exchange is going to work, they have to decide how the outside market's going to work. And states have to be very careful here. For example, individual market guarantee issue. In the exchange, it will have an open enrollment period. Certain time during the year where everybody can go in and purchase guarantee issue through the exchange. What if the outside market doesn't have an open enrollment period? What's going to happen to the outside market? Who's going to sell out there where they can get everybody sick whenever they come, whereas the exchange has only a small window in which to purchase that? States have to think about that. So even if your state says, I'm not doing a federal exchange, I'm not doing it, not doing the exchange, I'm not doing anything, you better look at your outside market to make sure the rules of the exchange don't severely injure your outside market and make sure you're getting all that taken care of. Deadlines, we have until November 16th, 2012 to get our application in, basically to say how we're going to do this. We're going to do a partner. We're going to do a state exchange. If you're silent, feds better get to work. January 2013, AHHS will certify the state exchanges as well as the partnerships. This is how we're going to move forward for the year to get ready for October 2013. Where initial open enrollment period. I'll tell you, between January and October, that is going to be a very busy time for states as we sit there and try to get all these plans certified up, ready to go. And then January 2014, coverage is effective. Funds are available. Tim already talked about that. And just very briefly on Medicaid options. They've added this. The Supreme Court said you got some more options on Medicaid. You don't have to do the expansion, but as was already discussed, if you do that, and don't do the expansion up to 133%, you're going to have a gap. You're going to have some people under 100% of poverty who don't have coverage. States have to deal with that and figure out how they're going to do that. So states, you want to expand under the ACA, go up to 133%? Do you want to not expand? Do you want to expand your old program? You want to cover them that way. Other options may be available, but we're going to need some guidance from CMS on that. So, and there's questions. If you have any questions at all, there's a couple of other people you can call on there other than me.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Brian. We can move the clicker along. Thanks very much. Next up is Krista Drobeck from the National Governors Association, where she directs the Health Division of NGA's Center for Best Practices. Krista's also a Hill veteran on the Senate side and has held senior positions both within HHS and at the Illinois State Department of Health Care and Family Services. And welcome back to Krista.
Thank you. My apologies that my slides did not make it in the packet. They will be available later. I hope that I don't have to rush through these, but they did put the big red clock right in front of me. So, and I'm standing between you and Mike. So this is actually a very timely discussion because NGA just had its annual meeting 2 weeks ago with our governors. And last Thursday and Friday, we had 40 states in town for a discussion about post-Supreme Court decision-making. So a lot of what I'm going to say is going to reflect what we've heard in the last few weeks. There's also a summary of our meeting with these 40 states on our website. So that goes into a little bit more detail. States are in very different places, as you know. There are some that are going to expand Medicaid and are already well on their way to a state-based exchange. There are other states that have declared that they will not be expanding Medicaid and that are most likely to have a federal exchange. But there's a whole group of states in the middle that have a lot of considerations, and the considerations are very similar. So they're considering whether to expand Medicaid. They have to decide whether they'll have a state-based partnership or a federally facilitated exchange. They're looking at the implications of the elections in November, and they're also looking at the pressure to reduce the federal budget deficit and how that is going to impact state spending. So that can't be underestimated. I know we're here mostly to talk about exchanges, but in light of the Supreme Court decision, states are really focusing a lot on Medicaid as well as the exchange. So I wanted to go through some of the things that states are considering as they look at whether or not to expand Medicaid. Obviously, there are a lot of questions, which Mike is well aware of, in thinking about whether you expand, a lot of states are wondering, well, could we just go up to 100 so that people between 100 and 133% of poverty have access to the exchange? If we just go to 100, there would be no gap. Can we expand over time? What happens to our DSH funding if we do only do a partial expansion? Can we get the 100% match rate if we just went up to 100? What happens to the children's expansion and the mandatory expansion to foster care kids up to age 26? There's, you know, some debate about whether that is included in the Supreme Court decision or whether it was sort of part of the old program. This is the last question. I think is a really, really important one. Is if we do expand up to 133% of poverty, can we go back down later? So if we run into significant budget challenges in the state, we're at the 90% match rate. We can't come up with the 10% state match. Can we go back down? And the statute reads that all individuals up to 133%. So it's very difficult to figure out what might happen there, given the way the statute reads. So right now, states are trying to estimate the impact on the state budget of going up to 133. And I know this may not sound like a lot when you're in the federal government. It sounds like, boy, we're being really generous. 90% is a lot. But states are cutting Medicaid right now because they can't carry the budget implications now. So, as you know, they are very carefully considering what it really means to have an additional group of people on Medicaid and the state paying 10%. So I think a lot of state officials right now are trying to figure out what are the right assumptions in estimating the impact on Medicaid. And there's a lot of numbers floating around out there, so they want to make sure they get it right. So they are trying to figure out, for example, how many people can we expect that are already eligible and not enrolled that may enroll, because those people are not going to get the 100% match. So what's the budget impact of that? What are the costs of our current state-only programs? So there's a lot of mental health programs that are paid for with state-only dollars. Uncompensated care pools, the state high-risk pool, all of those things are paid for with state dollars that if those people become eligible for Medicaid, they could actually reduce the cost to the state. So it's something, you know, to think about what might our savings be if we did the Medicaid expansion. And then, of course, there's what are the implications of the DSH payment reductions. Now, the secretary in the statute has authority to come up with a fair formula, but the problem is there's going to be less money. So either way you look at it, there's going to be less dollars for uncompensated care through DSH. What's going to be the provider reaction to that? Obviously, if you don't do the expansion, you're still going to have uncompensated care and people going to the hospital. And if those hospitals get less DSH funds, what is their reaction going to be? What is the cost to the state and the counties and to actually individually privately insured people if there continues to be uninsured people that go to the hospital as they do today? What are the administrative costs to the state to have new people on Medicaid? And then if you look at the expansion population and the characteristics of the expansion population, are they going to be more expensive than current? So how much might we expect these folks to cost? There is definitely a disproportionate number of people in the expansion population that have mental illness and behavioral health challenges. For some states, that makes the decision clear. Well, that means we must keep them on Medicaid because the Medicaid benefit package for mental illness is very good and rich. And if you have them in the exchange, well, the benefit packages for behavioral health aren't as great. So, it also factors into whether you need to keep community mental health dollars in your state budget. And then finally, the states that have done Medicaid expansion already have found that the people are definitely more costly than the current parents, but they're less costly than disabled enrollees, so they're somewhere in the middle. Oh, and also, you're looking at a new kind of churn. You know, we all talk about churn a lot. Well, what happens if they go between Medicaid and the exchange and the continuity of care, et cetera? Well, now you've got people going between insurance and no insurance, and so they've got obviously very different networks of care. So on the exchange, so you've got states trying to work through all those Medicaid issues, and now they're also working through all their exchange issues. And in deciding whether to go for a federal partnership or state-based exchange, states are thinking, well, could we start with a partnership and maybe move to a state-based exchange? In the partnership model, what's the sustainability model? So how do we pay for it? So if we're going to do consumer assistance and plan management, how do we pay for the additional administrative costs on an ongoing basis? Because I guess the states, you know, the federal government may have a user fee in the exchange, but the state has to consider whether they would have a user fee, and so they're trying to figure out the costs of what a partnership actually means. They're also wondering, well, what's the state level of effort? So somebody's got to change their programming language so that the two programs can talk to each other as they build an interface between Medicaid and exchange. So what's the level of effort in doing that? What does the memorandum of understanding with the federal government look like? Obviously, many states can apply for grants to cover a lot of these administrative costs up front. It's just the sustainability, the long term. Many states, as you may know, have advanced planning documents. So they've actually used the 90-10 match opportunity in Medicaid to build eligibility systems. And in doing that, they have agreed to build an interface between the federal exchange or the state exchange and the Medicaid program. So there's a lot to work to do on that interface. And then finally, do you make your own Medicaid eligibility determinations, or do you accept the assessment from the federal exchange? So do you have Medicaid folks in your own departments making those eligibility determinations? And obviously that impacts administrative costs. Okay, I have 2 minutes left, so I'm going to hurry up here. Market questions. So if you want to drive people between 100 and 133% into the exchange to shift the costs more to the federal side of the ledger, How do you do that? Can you pay for their premiums? Because obviously there aren't premiums in Medicaid like there are in the private market, and a lot of people may not pay those premiums at that income level. So could the states pay their premium? Or could providers pay it, for example? So how do you make the impact on low-income people less so they may choose the exchange? What happens to the marketplace if those folks go into the exchange? As I mentioned before, behavioral health is a disproportionate share of behavioral health needs, and what about their benefit package in the private market? And then, of course, what, as Brian already just talked about, what are the effects of the market reforms on insurance premiums and whether people would take up the exchange at that income level? Obviously, everybody is well aware of the impact of the election. States have to declare 10 days after the election what their decision is related to whether they'll have a partnership state or federal exchange. So there has to be some groundwork laid, because in the blueprint for the exchange, states have to complete 42 activities to be a state exchange and 19 activities to be a partnership exchange. So if you're going to attest that you're going to get some of that done, obviously some of that work has to start now in considering what you might do. So that does make some politically a little bit difficult as you're waiting for the election. And then finally, I just want to mention the federal budget. You know, everybody is worried about the state budget, but many, many governors are worried about the debate going on here in Washington about deficit reduction. And if Medicaid becomes part of a deficit reduction deal, what does that mean for the federal match rate for states? So it obviously goes into their consideration. You know, if we go up to 133, what happens if you decide that we don't get 90% match anymore, that we go back to our regular FMAP or some kind of blended rate, and then we've got all these new people on our rolls, and we can't afford them, and we can't go down in eligibility. So the federal budget has huge is just a big factor for many governors in considering whether or not to expand Medicaid. Great. And I had 1 second left.
Great job. I don't
need it. Terrific. Thank you, Kristen. I'll now return to Mike Hash, who's the Acting Director of the Center for Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight within HHS. And he's also, at the same time, the actual director of the HHS Office of Health Reform. He's a veteran of the White House Office of Health Reform. Also of the respected health policy alternatives firm here in D.C. He's a longtime senior staff member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee and at one point the acting director of what is now CMS. Michael Hash, thanks for being with us. And I should say, because we had to shift the time around, Mike is going to have to leave long before the Q&A is over. So we appreciate your carving out as much time as you could.
Thanks, Ed. I'm delighted to be here and to join with the Alliance and my colleagues here on the dais to talk to all of you about what we're doing at SSIO to implement the Affordable Care Act. As everyone in this room knows, we now know the Supreme Court has found the Affordable Care Act to be fully constitutional, and that decision ensures that all hardworking middle-class families will get the health care security that the law was designed to provide. From our perspective at HHS, and more particularly at SSIO, it simply means that we can continue moving ahead with full steam to implement the law. Today, I want to talk to you briefly about where we are and the progress that we are seeing in the establishment of the health insurance marketplaces, the affordable insurance exchanges. As I think several people on the panel have already said, at least at HHS, our strong preference, our premise, in fact, is that we want each state to establish its own exchange, because the state-based exchange provides states with the most amount of flexibility and involvement in running these new marketplaces. At the same time, we know that some states will need additional time and assistance before being able to run their own exchanges, or they may choose to work in partnership with us, as has been pointed out, in the context of a federally facilitated exchange. We've seen what we think is really good progress around the country with the establishment of state-based exchanges, the process of building them, and we expect to see more now that the Supreme Court has provided a clear and final decision. As I think, again, many of you may know in this room, 34 states and the District of Columbia have received approximately $850 million in exchange establishment level one, level two grants, or cooperative agreements, as we call them. And those funds, of course, are designed to provide the resources that are necessary to build the exchanges. A few weeks ago, we announced additional opportunities for states to apply for exchange establishment grants through the end, really, of calendar year 2014. These funds are clearly available for states to use beyond 2014 as they have to continue to work on their exchanges. This, we believe, will ensure that states have the support and the time necessary to build the best exchanges that meet the needs of their residents. We also announced that these grant funds, these establishment grant funds, are available to fully fund exchange-related activities during the startup year of an exchange. We are expecting to award additional sets of grants in the middle of next month, in the middle of August, and we'll offer further opportunities to apply for these grants in each subsequent quarter between now and the end of calendar year 2014. This past May, as again you know, we published the exchange application, or at least what we refer to as the blueprint, that states are going to use in order to receive approval for their state-based exchanges. And we are in the process of getting comments on that blueprint. We'll be finalizing it later this summer. Our exchange blueprint is structured around, of course, the functions and activities that states need to perform in order to be certified as a state-based exchange or a state partnership within a federally facilitated exchange. The blueprint, as I think Kristen just noticed in her mentioned in her remarks, is due generally 30 days before the beginning of a calendar year. But in the case of the first year of 2014, we're asking for states to complete the blueprint by November the 16th. And the other states that are still on their way to be a full state-based exchange can apply in subsequent years. Now, here's some of the latest data, at least, that we have assembled about the progress among the states. First, as of the 24th of July, this few days ago, 13 states have sent a declaration letter expressing their intent to establish a state-based exchange. We now have, as I think I mentioned earlier, 35 states, including the District of Columbia, who have already received establishment grant funding. Obviously, we're expecting there will be more as we move through that funding opportunity cycle. 19 states have already established the authority that's necessary to operate an exchange, whether that be state legislation or an executive order. And 17 states have hired or are in the process of hiring an executive director or its equivalent to actually manage the operations of a state-based exchange. With respect to the critical function of building the information technology infrastructure, about 42 states have completed an information technology analysis, a so-called gap analysis, to see what they need to do. 22 of our states have, in fact, issued requests for proposals from vendors and contractors in order to start building the systems that are necessary to support the exchange functions. Now let me say a couple of words about the federally facilitated exchange. As I said at the outset, our strong preference is for states to establish a state-based exchange, giving them the maximum amount of flexibility to tailor their exchanges to the needs of their own marketplaces. However, we realize that not all states will be ready to establish these exchanges by 2014. So we're on track to set up the federally facilitated exchange in those states that aren't certified as of January 2013. The federally facilitated exchange is on track, on time, to go live October 2013, which I think many of you know is the beginning of the first open season associated with both the individual and small group markets. Like states building their own exchanges, we are covering the major operational areas, the functions that the law requires exchanges to perform, plan management, the eligibility and enrollment functions, the determination of advanced premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions, the financial management responsibilities that exchanges have for the flow of funds, such as the payments, of course, to the issuers of qualified health plans. Our federally facilitated exchange is being built in a very collaborative manner with the states. We're using industry standards for the exchange of data, which is so critical to a seamless consumer experience, which we're all striving to achieve. The first round of testing with the states and the insurance carriers, some of whom will be using the federally facilitated exchange, is currently underway. The federally facilitated exchange is being built so that it's easily accessible and scalable so that we will be able to meet the needs in any number of states who require an FFE or a partnership model with the FFE. We're also building what we refer to as the Federal Data Services Hub. That's on track with a contract awarded earlier this year to establish that. You may know the Data Services Hub is going to be a single place, where the FFE and in every state-based exchange can use to securely validate the information supplied by applicants with the relevant federal agency partners that are called upon to help with that task. Soon we are going to release the federally facilitated exchange implementation schedule to states so that they can align their own work with the schedule of our work on the FFE. And we're, of course, going to release additional guidance about how we are implementing the FFE and the partnership arrangement with respect to plan management services and consumer assistance programs. So I think you can see that, at least from our vantage point, we certainly believe that we're making significant progress on the actual build, both of state exchanges, a partnership arrangement under a federally facilitated exchange, and the federally facilitated exchange itself. The design of all of this is moving forward, I think, on pace, and we are we're doing everything we can to make sure that we're ready for 2014. We're pleased, as I said at the outset, with the progress that we see and with our colleagues in the states, with our colleagues at the within the insurance industry, and all of the stakeholders who are helping us create these new marketplaces where consumers can access quality, affordable health care coverage. And we want to assure everyone that we're going to be ready, and we believe our state partners will be ready, to make the promise of the Affordable Care Act a reality for all Americans. Thank you for having me here, and I'm be delighted to participate with my colleagues with some questions that you may have. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you, Mike. That's terrific. As Mike said, we've got questions that you have that we'd like to put to the panel, and perhaps an early emphasis on Mr. Hash because of his early departure. There are green cards in your packets. You can write the question, hold them up, and they'll be brought forward. There are microphones that you can use to voice your question, in which case I would ask that you identify yourself and keep the question as short as you can so that we can get to as many as we can. I should have said this earlier, but we are summarizing today's briefing live on Twitter using the hashtag #AHRExchanges. Since you're here, feel free to share your thoughts and favorite moments from the briefing. And as Zach Thompson has told me to say, we'll retweet the best of them, which will likely make you rich and famous. We have someone at the microphone, and let's start with that.
Bernadette Fernandez, Congressional Research Service. My question specifically is for Brian, but actually before I get to that, there's a couple of things I wanted to add. You mentioned that maybe one of the motivations to get an exchange up and running is all the market reforms. There's also a few other things that you might want to remember. There's the termination of the pre-existing condition high-risk pools that were established. So we go back to what was in the states before, but a third of the states don't have those high-risk pools. There's the termination of the health coverage tax credit, where some of those individuals might get access to tax credits and exchanges. So, you know, there's a lot of moving pieces. And then just a final reminder that there's that provision in the law that basically said members and their personal staff have to get coverage that's established under the law. So self-preservation, that might be a motive.
This means you.
Yeah. So the question to Brian is about the reinsurance program and the risk adjustment program. And at the risk of getting wonky really fast, there's some concern that the language isn't really clear about what happened, who establishes those programs, and who essentially is the oversight authority if a state decides not to establish an exchange and it becomes a federally facilitated exchange. Now, I just might be spending too much time around lawyers, but there is some. It's not necessarily disagreement. We're just kind of unsure about the language. So I'm curious to hear your read on the provisions and kind of what you see applying in a federal exchange situation.
The way we're reading it is under a federally facilitated exchange, it would be the federal government that would do the risk adjustment program. And they've established early constructs on how they're going to do it, but we're expecting this fall to have some more details exactly how they plan to operate a risk adjustment program. So it would be their responsibility. Now, whether they would contract with somebody or something like that, I don't know, but it would be their responsibility in a federally facilitated exchange or a partnership exchange, which is an FFE. But in a state-based exchange, it would be the option of the state to, within the requirements of the law, do the risk adjustment program kind of in the way they want to do it. On reinsurance, we see it as they've given the state the option to operate that and given some options about who, what kind of entities in the state could do it. But if they don't do it, then we see the federal government having to do it. So that's our reading.
Okay. Sarah?
I'm just reading a couple questions for Mike Hash before he leaves. With enrollment beginning in October of 2013, can we expect guidance on essential health benefits before that deadline, or does HHS believe that the bulletin provides enough certainty to move forward? I think that it's October 2013, not this October. But yep.
Yes, we are obviously planning to issue and go through the rulemaking process for establishing essential health benefits. I think, again, we have already issued a bulletin last December in which we laid out our intentions with respect to how we would define with the states the essential health benefit package. We have also put out some questions and answers to fully flesh out some of those issues that came up in the context of the bulletin from last December. Got a lot of comments on that bulletin, and we are using those comments as the basis for putting together the essential health benefit proposed rule, which we expect to have out shortly.
And just another question for Mike. When will the details of the federal exchange be released?
The federally facilitated exchange. We put out, many of you may know, we put out a guidance document in May in which we described the federally facilitated exchange and our intentions. We realized that not every operational detail was included in that guidance, and so we are in the process of formulating additional guidance for later this summer related to the federally facilitated exchange.
Please, go ahead, Brian.
No.
While I've got you here, I'm just curious, on that stuff that's coming out later on the federally facilitated exchange, will that include kind of the cost estimate? I'm getting that from a lot of states. They want to know how much the federal facilitated exchange is going to cost so they can kind of compare it to how much it would cost for them to operate it. So I'm just curious, would that and kind of how you expect to fund it going to be in there? Or that
I think the funding issue is really a budgetary issue, and I'm not sure that'll be in the guidance itself. But it's certainly something that we have in the president's budget and is a part of our planning for the future. But the guidance that, that we're preparing now to elaborate on the May guidance with respect to is more detail about the operational aspects of the federally facilitated exchange.
Yes. Krista?
I just want to add something, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but as far as I know, the federal government can only assess the fees, the user fees, inside the exchange, whereas a state has the option to do a more broad-based user fee or tax. So in the federal exchange, it could be higher cost per user for the operations of the exchange. Just want to mention that.
Do we have any notion of how much money we're talking about, either on a per population basis or overall, in either the federal or the federally facilitated exchange or the or state exchanges?
So it depends, too, on the size of the population that you expect to be in the exchange if you're going to use user fees. But,
right.
I've heard some smaller states use numbers between $5 and $8, but then larger states using smaller numbers. So it, it totally depends. And if you look at Utah, that could be.
I completely agree with Kristen on this, is that it varies widely depending on the size and scope of the exchange operations. We clearly are going to be working closely with the states. Our expectation and desire is to leverage the resources that already exist and the capacity that Brian's colleagues across the country and departments of insurance already have in place to perform a number of the functions of certifying and reviewing qualified health plans. So clearly we're thinking some of the resources related to the activities of reviewing qualified health plans can leverage the existing resources in states where they already have capacities to perform these kinds of functions.
But we will charge you.
There's a factual question that's been raised, and it's a certain level of confusion if you don't know what folks are talking about. The statute says that the Medicaid expansion covers people up to 133% of the federal poverty line. Several of our speakers have referred to 138% of the poverty line. Would somebody please explain the difference?
There's a 5 percentage point disregard of income that's built into the statute, so you just have to add that on to the 133% and you get to 138%.
And this is part of the standardized income calculation that is new, also new to Medicaid.
Right.
Very good. Here's one that has not been raised before, so far as I can tell. Can employees of a large employer agree in a collective bargaining agreement to enroll as a group or as individuals in a particular plan sold on an exchange? And why is that important?
Well, I would say if the state decides to expand to allow large group to come into the exchange, then that could certainly be an option for them to agree to basically purchase on the exchange rather than have a self-insured or other product outside the exchange. But there is a decision that needs to be made by the state.
Yeah, Brian's right. There is a provision in the statute that defines the employer size for the small group market as up to 100 employees. A state may actually choose early on to limit it to 50 employees or less. And then later, I think it's maybe 2017,
correct.
States can make a decision about whether they want to enlarge the eligibility of larger employers above 100 to actually come into the shop exchange and shop for and provide coverage for their workers and families.
There's been a lot of discussion about whether employers will drop health insurance and expect that their employees will go into the exchange. But, of course, if an employer does that, then they face the penalty if their employees get
health insurance through the exchange, but of course they would also lose the tax benefits there that are now, there now, which are quite substantial, as well as all of the other labor market reasons why employers offer health insurance. And so unless you have very low-wage employees, it just doesn't make economic sense for employers to do that, but we'll see what they do do.
Hi, I'm Tom Brady with Acero Health Technologies. We're a technology firm, and this question is directed at Mike Hash. Earlier this year in February, CSI released a bulletin related to actuarial value and cost sharing. And I'm just curious, when you talked about regulations being released soon related to the exchanges and the federally facilitated exchange, if that's going to include cost sharing details?
It will. It'll include details around the actuarial value determination for qualified health plans, as well as the methodology for providing eligible individuals cost-sharing reductions that are provided for in the Act as well.
Will that include the reimbursement mechanisms for the health plans?
Yes, it will.
Okay. Thank you.
Mike, I hate to keep putting you on the on the hot seat, but we'll have you go out in a blaze of glory then. Can you comment on whether the federal government will subsidize states that expand coverage but up to less than 133% of poverty?
Actually, I can't comment on that because I'm actually here representing CSIO, but my colleagues in the Medicaid part of CMS, I'm sure would be happy to talk with you about that, but my purview doesn't extend to the Medicaid program.
NGA has a letter on our website that we've sent to the secretary asking a very similar question. So we're all anxiously awaiting guidance on that.
Sarah?
I think we have a couple of people with the mic.
Yes, go ahead.
He was
ahead of me. Sure. Well, first, terrific panel. Thank you guys for the discussion. Super helpful. My name is Frederick Asasi. I'm working with the advisory board. We work with about 3,100 hospitals and health systems in the country. So after this Supreme Court ruling, tons and tons of interest from our members about the rollout of exchanges and the Medicaid expansion, to Chris's comments. We've got lots of providers who are very anxious to find out if their state's going to, in fact, expand Medicaid, if they're going to have a donut hole in coverage for a certain population. So super important. A question to you, which is anecdotally throughout the country, as we've been talking to many hospitals and health systems, they're reporting that the plan community, the insurance community in their states, when they're discussing with them exchange products, the starting premise is that the payment rates for private coverage in the exchange must be set at Medicaid payment levels. And I was wondering if you guys could comment on that. It seems like that's not a very accurate reading of the statute. And also, to the extent possible, really a comment if you could provide some guidance. I think the provider community can really benefit from that.
My quick answer to that is I'm not aware of anything in the Affordable Care Act that imposes requirements on issuers of health insurance or qualified health plans and the providers that will actually deliver the benefits. That's a matter between the health plan and the providers, and I don't believe there are provisions in the Affordable Care Act that actually speak to that.
And Frederick, I think the CBO assumptions—you should check this. You should check the CBO assumptions too, because I think that they assumed a higher rate in the commercial market.
Yeah, I pointed that out to people. Great point, Krista.
I'm sorry, Ed, I have to leave.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask one very last quick question, Mike?
Yes.
You can, Rodney can ask Peel, it. He's going to be gone, though.
Rodney Peel with the American Optometric Association, and. A lot of you have asked about specific regulations that they're anxious to see you guys come out with. Mr. Jost earlier talked about some of the sections of the law that he thinks are self-executing and that you won't need to do regulations. Can HHS provide any guidance on which sections of the law that they're not going to do regulations on so that we're not waiting for them or asking you for them anymore?
I think my answer to that question is I don't have a list of what's in and what's out. I think clearly we want to address all of the aspects of the Affordable Care Act, either if as necessary through rulemaking or through guidance of one kind or another. So to the extent that there are areas or aspects of the law that are not clear to you or anyone else, we should talk about it because we want to make it as simple and easy as possible for people to get answers to those kinds of questions. So we're definitely receptive to sitting down and talking about any questions you have about how we're going to apply various provisions of the law. So
Thanks very much.
Yep. Thank you all.
Thanks very much, Mike.
If I could respond quickly to the question about self-executing provisions, as to some of those provisions already there have been rules proposed or guidance issued. So I didn't mean by that to imply that there would be no guidance or rules on those. However, there has been some discussion about what happens if we have a regime change at the end of the year. And I just wanted to make the point that until and unless the statute is repealed, some provisions of the law will go into effect regardless of who is running the administration, including final rules that have already been issued. So I think we'll have a very interesting situation if that happens.
And, Tim, there's a question here that kind of builds on that same premise. How will federal exchanges be implemented if Congress fails to appropriate adequate funds for the purpose?
I'm sorry, Mike just left. That's an interesting question. There's a lot of money within CMS, and I assume maybe some of that can slosh around. And, of course, there's already some money that has been appropriated, but that will be an interesting question.
Krista?
So in the appropriations question, I just want to distinguish between the administrative costs and the cost to actually build the federal exchange, because the cost to build the federal exchange are actually appropriated in the Affordable Care Act. So until January 1st of 2015, there's essentially unlimited amount of money that could be put into building the federal exchange. The appropriations comes into play on the administrative side for funding staff at CMS. So I just want to make that distinction.
It's a question for Brian Webb. Can you elaborate on what states are doing with respect to regulating outside the exchange market? A lot of activity or not much at all? You mentioned open enrollment. Are there other major areas of concern?
There are a lot of areas of concern. And right now, the NEIC is developing model laws, model regulations. We've done white papers addressing issues such as adverse selection, trying to basically educate people on that relationship between inside and outside, what states need to do for the entire marketplace, regardless of whether it's an exchange or not. So we hope to have, by the end of the year, the model laws that states would need to adopt early next year to put into place all the 2014 market reforms. Including that will be some guidance on some other items they may want to do in their marketplaces in order to avoid adverse selection and things like that. So that's been the place where we typically kind of develop those proposals, and those will be developed by the end of the year. So
I'll just add to that, too. On your materials list, there's a paper by Kevin Lucia and colleagues at Georgetown where they looked at the implementation by states of the early market reforms, the 2010 reforms, such as bans on rescissions, bans on lifetime benefit limits. And the striking finding of the report is that nearly all states had moved forward to implement those rules into their own either state laws or issuing regulations or sub-regulatory guidance. And I guess my question for Brian, too, is given that sort of significant compliance and action by states across the country, what that says about the 2014 reforms, if states are going to move assertively forward in the next 18 months or so on those.
We certainly hope so, because there is that kind of hammer out there that if the state doesn't do something either legislatively or regulatorily or just in practice to enforce those reforms, then the federal government will have to. And there is not a Department of Insurance in America that would want to say, no, we don't want to regulate this. We did have, now I'm from California, I worked for Governor Wilson at the time that HIPAA came down, and California was one of the two states, along with Missouri, that said, we're not doing HIPAA. And CMS, well, at the time HICFA, out of San Francisco, had to enforce HIPAA in California. But that was such a small area such a small item compared to what we're doing now, that the states, talking to the commissioners, they don't want a situation where they're not in control of their marketplaces and where what they're doing on review is kind of pushed aside. So we think they'll get there.
There's a question here, actually several questions on this topic, and fortunately we have anticipated it by putting materials related to this question in your packets. Some legal scholars are making the argument that the ACA does not provide for subsidies in a federally facilitated exchange as opposed to a state-run exchange. Would anyone on the panel like to comment on this argument? And if you assume that the courts were to agree with that argument, are there any workarounds that you can think of?
I would like to respond to that argument. I have responded to that argument at length on the Health Affairs blog, and my comments are included in the materials. The problem here is that at several points in the statute, language was picked up from the Senate Finance Committee bill in the final Senate bill that talks about premium tax credits being available to enrollees of in plans established, enrolled in plans through exchanges established by the states under Section 1311. That language is also used in other places. For example, the Medicaid maintenance of effort provision also applies until exchanges are established by the state. So you have to take the bitter with the sweet on that one. But the argument is being made by some people that means that premium tax credits cannot be made available through the federal exchanges, which are established under Section 1321. If you first look at the legislative history of the bill, you can see that that Congress never intended that exchanges, federal exchanges, would operate any differently than the state exchanges. And if you look at the language of Section 1321 itself, it's clear that a federal exchange effectively becomes a state exchange, and states that elect not to establish a federal exchange, a state exchange, and has all of the power and authority of a state exchange. Also, the Health Care and Education Reconciliation Act, which amended the Affordable Care Act after the act was adopted and signed, explicitly refers to premium tax credits being provided through the federal exchange. So the language of the law could have been drafted better. As we all know, nobody intended this bill to become the final law. It just happened that way because of the Massachusetts Senate election. But if you look at the legislative history, if you look at the structure of the act, if you look at fact of the language of the statute, and certainly if you look at the Reconciliation Act, it's clear that premium tax credits can be provided through federal as well as state exchanges. The other question, however, is what happens if somebody decides to sue and challenge that? The only plaintiffs that I can see out there that have standing to challenge it would be employers who would have to pay penalties because their employees received tax credits through federal exchanges. But the statute explicitly refers to the exaction that is placed on employers for if they don't offer health insurance or adequate or affordable insurance and their employees go into the exchange. That's explicitly referred to as a tax. And all of us remember from the Supreme Court case that one of the big questions there was the Tax Anti-Injunction Act and whether that applied. It clearly would apply under the Supreme Court's reasoning to this provision, which means that it would be 2015 probably before any employer would be able to even get into court to challenge premium tax credits being issued through federal exchanges. So I think it's clear to me that and this, by the way, was also the position that the CBO took in its report last week, that premium tax credits would be available through both the state and federal exchanges, and that's the position it's always taken. And as one of my colleagues has said, Congress people may not pay much attention to what other people are saying on the floor, but they do pay attention to what the CBO says. So I think when you put all of that together, the argument is overwhelming that premium tax credits will and be available legally through the federally facilitated exchanges.
Tim, if we can take advantage of your professorial expertise on one related question. There has been an assertion that because the Supreme Court has now labeled the penalties as taxes, that the law is unconstitutional because it didn't originate in the House, and the House, by constitutional edict, is required to be the originator of all tax legislation. How's that grab you?
My recollection is that the bill did originate in the House, and that the language was substituted, the Senate language was substituted into a House bill. But I could be wrong on that, but that's my recollection. And in any event, I don't think the Supreme Court wants to do this all over again. I think they made it clear that what they thought on this legislation. There are, of course, other questions out there, like whether the IPAB is constitutional or whether the ban on Medicare payments to physician-owned hospitals is constitutional. There's some other issues bubbling around contraception. But on the basic question of the constitutionality of the statute, I think we've heard the final word from the Supreme Court.
Okay. Yeah. There's a question about the differences in the shop exchange or the small business exchanges and the individual exchanges. In each state will operate two different exchanges. They can merge those into one. So this question. Can you speak about the differences in administration and enrollment when it comes to the shop exchanges compared to the state-run and the federally facilitated individual exchanges?
Well, there are significant differences in how people will be accessing coverage in the shop exchange, because obviously in the individual, you're coming as an individual or a family. You're accessing coverage for yourself. In the shop exchange, there's going to be some options available where you have an employer involved. The employer can come to the shop exchange and say, well, I'm going to allow all of my employees to choose from a particular level of coverage. So everybody can choose from the silver coverage or the bronze coverage or something to that effect, and then let them all choose. We believe most states also will allow employers to come in and just choose a plan, and all their employees would get that plan as an option to them. Also, obviously, there's not the individual subsidies available. Instead, there are tax credits available to the employers. They're limited in time and amount, but there are those available rather than the individual. So it's really a different dynamic coming in. You're administering. You're not looking at each individual's income and coming in and trying to determine whether they're eligible for Medicaid, whether they're eligible for subsidies. You are instead looking at them as a group coming in. And how does that employer want to kind of access coverage through that exchange and let people make their choices? So it will be administrated differently, although I don't know of any states who are out there creating two different boards, one for shop and one for individual, not getting two different vendors. All that kind of backroom stuff will probably be the same people. But as you access, it will look differently, and they will ask you different questions, and it will be a different administratively in how you get coverage and sign up. So, and maybe even different options in what carriers you have available and coverage options, too, as they are now.
And just to follow up, the key question that states are facing, the states are looking at, are establishing their exchanges, is whether to merge their individual and small group markets, with
right.
Most deciding just to wait and see and study the issue, and I wondered what you
Yeah, thinking. People looked at Massachusetts. Massachusetts did that. They combined their individual and small group market. But people have to remember, they had already done a tremendous amount of reform in their individual market. So that wasn't a big shock to that system. In most states, just the fact that we're putting all these new reforms in the individual market will be a tremendous shock. So then trying to combine that with this kind of unknown group of people, how healthy they are, they have no idea how effective the individual mandate is, we have no idea how effective subsidies, we have no idea, saying to the small group market, we're not going to bring this whole group in together with you. Most states are not going to do that. They'll let that play out, and then maybe in the future, we don't know. They may make the same decision as Massachusetts. They may not.
This questioner observes that Tim Jost had said that states that haven't yet taken executive or legislative action to create an exchange have probably missed the boat. And this person would like to set the over-under at 19 fully state-run exchanges and ask what the panelists think about that. Would you take the over-under?
Over.
More than 19 will happen. Krista, what do you think? You don't have to admit to
it. I'm not a betting woman, sorry.
I think we're going to see a lot of different approaches taken. So if we're counting partnership exchanges, then probably over. If we're looking at strict state-run exchanges with no federal involvement, maybe under, but it remains to be seen. But if the state waits until a lot of states, the legislature's out of session, and if the executive doesn't have the authority to do it by itself, you're not going to be able to vote in the spring of 2013 to establish an exchange and have one up and running.
I just add to that. I mean, I also think, too, as states are running their exchanges and they've got them underway, whether that will have a sort of encouraging effect on other states to jump in when it becomes more clear that how these can run, what the different options for states are. In your packet, you'll see just the bare outlines of what states have established their exchanges are doing right now, and it's striking the amount of discretion that they have allotted to their exchanges to make key decisions about how they're going to run in the next few years.
There were at one point a number of states talking about collaborating with each other and sharing some of the common functions in a way that would be able to realize some economies of scale. Are those continuing? Are they growing? Have they withered? Or is there any result that might be helpful there?
Yeah. Yes, those discussions are still happening, for sure. There's a lot of interest in whether one state could conduct the backroom operations of another state's exchange.
Okay.
And there was an early innovator grant for a group of New England states working on technology together, so there may be different ways in which states can work together.
Yes, Carl.
Yeah, Carl Polzer, American Healthcare Association. My question goes to consumers. Like a year from now when they're thinking about going to the exchange, resources for counseling and education. So they're going to have to be making complex decisions about potential individual penalties if they're uninsured, the affordability of their employer-based coverage, and the affordability of exchange coverage, or if they're eligible for Medicaid. And a lot of these folks, especially in the part of the market most effective where it intersects with employer-based coverage, where there's low-wage workers, they're not very literate with their health benefits. So do we have resources for that? So it seems to be a large, need for that.
Yes. One of the objectives very soon here will be to start developing the education programs for navigators, for agents and brokers, especially in small business. Most of them use agents and brokers as their primary educator because they need to know what they need to tell people. They need to know about the new Medicaid rules because they're going to run into a lot more of those. They're going to need to know the subsidies. They'll need to know kind of the exchange versus outside the exchange, what options are available. They'll need to know, frankly, why are rates going up or down based on the rating rule changes. So we are in that process. We have a meeting in Atlanta coming up where we're going to start that process of developing education materials for them, for consumers, for also even the consumer people within the departments so they can be well-educated as we can. As we saw with Massachusetts, it takes a lot of effort and, frankly, a lot of resources to get people the knowledge they need to make the right and good choices. So it's a point well taken, and people are working very hard on that.
I would just follow up with maybe a question to Tim, just to elaborate on. The exchanges are envisioned as a central place where people will go to and find out about their range of insurance options available to them, whether tax credits, whether Medicaid, whether the Children's Health Insurance Program. And so the question is, to a key implementation issue, is whether the state exchanges will be able to assess eligibility for both the premium tax credits and Medicaid, and eligibility through the Medicaid program, and how that process moves forward in a seamless fashion so that people are immediately enrolled in the affordability programs that they're eligible for. And Tim has written a little bit about the rule on this from HHS, and there are some questions about whether the exchanges can enroll people who are eligible for the Medicaid program.
Well, the way in which the rule is written, the exchange will either, at the state's option, be allowed to enroll people, or they'll be able to do an assessment and then refer the individual to the state, which will then do the enrollment. I think the presumption is that since the eligibility is going to be based, in states that decide to expand, percentage of federal poverty level and that's relationship to modified adjusted gross income, that this is going to be a fairly straightforward determination, and if the exchange determines eligibility, that should pretty much decide it. But this is going to be a very different way of doing business than Medicaid programs in many states have been accustomed to. And so it is going to be a new experience for everybody trying to do this handoff. The hope really is that you'll be able to do real-time determinations of eligibility for the premium tax credits for Medicaid, that people will be able to go onto the web or go into wherever a navigator is located and, you know, a half hour later come out enrolled in an insurance plan with their eligibility determined. Whether that will take place all the time, probably not. There will be some complicated questions sometime, but that's the goal and that's the hope and that's where we really need to get.
And I've heard John Kingsdale talk about the patient-friendly experience, the consumer-friendly experience that they were working to establish in the Massachusetts Connector, which is, I guess, the only fairly elaborate exchange operating as opposed to just an informational function in Utah. And I wonder if that would give you some optimism about the ability to provide that information in a useful way in a lot of other states.
Yes.
I guess that came out as a rhetorical question. I'm sorry.
Because there you don't have all of the, I mean, the federal, the exchange will have more functionality than the Massachusetts exchange does. But it is very impressive. I saw John McDonough in a meeting like this a few months ago go through the whole enrollment process and while the clock was running for a hypothetical person. And hopefully that's the way it's going to work a lot of the time.
And I guess a takeaway too from Massachusetts is their coordination early on with Mass Health, the Medicaid and CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. So there's a great deal of interaction coordination with that in terms of how to enroll people based on the experience of Mass Health in that state.
One thing, by the way, that I haven't heard too much about recently, but starting in September, health plans are going to start, and employers are going to start issuing the summary of benefits and coverage that HHS issued a rule on earlier this year based on work that the NEAC did. And I think that's going to lay some very important groundwork for the exchanges because for the first time, anybody who applies for, enrolls in, is shopping for an insurance plan will be able to get a four-page, although they interpreted that to mean double-sided, so now an eight-page summary of all of the important features of the plan that will be exactly comparable plan to plan. So you're going to have something that works like the nutrition labels on food cans or mileage labels or efficiency labels on appliances. So consumers will actually be able to intelligently shop for health insurance. There have been surveys that show that people would rather go to the dentist and have a tooth pulled than shop for health insurance. But in any event, it's going to make it a much more consumer-friendly experience, and that's going to happen a year before the exchange is open. So we're going to start having something of a glide path into the exchange experience.
First of all, thanks for putting this together. My name's James Williams, and I do some work with Rocky Mountain Health Plans. And this is a question from Brian, and this is around non-discrimination protections in the exchanges. HHS put some pretty landmark guidance and rulings coming out around protections on sexual orientation and gender identity in the individual and group exchanges. And I wonder how the exchanges, particularly from a state insurance commissioner perspective, is planning on handling any complaints or egregiousness from insurers who actually aren't following those protections within their plans.
It's not something we've discussed thus far. We can certainly do that. I mean, generally, the case is any kind of complaint that would be a violation of state or federal law, they would take it very seriously. They would talk to the company if there's a pattern of it. They would take action against them and would have authority under their license to fine them, et cetera. So a lot of things they can do to a company that's violating those laws. So I'm sure all departments would take that very seriously.
And do you see that as a question for the insurance commissioner or the Office of Civil Rights? Do you see where that lies from a jurisdictional perspective?
Well, it would be Department of Insurance under the contract and making sure they're complying with all the rules and regulations. Obviously, if it folds over into an actual civil rights issue, you can get your AGs and those involved as well, and that often happens.
Thanks.
Got a question that was actually raised in a newsletter that I read a couple of days ago, asking what the panelists' thoughts are about the possibility of low-income people relocating to states that do expand Medicaid from states that don't, and the economic impact on the respective states. Krista?
The best thing you can do is take a look at states that have already expanded Medicaid and the impact that has had. I know in Illinois, where I came from, we have a program that covers all kids. And I know one of the worries was that sick kids were going to come to Illinois. And I haven't looked at it recently, so I can't tell you the verdict, but I would definitely look at the experience of existing states that have expanded Medicaid.
Sarah?
Just another question on mobility. What about portability of insurance through the exchanges? What happens if someone with coverage through an exchange crosses state lines? Does that mean they need to re-enroll in that state's exchange, or can they maintain their coverage?
Well, health insurance is different than a lot of other insurance because it is so tied into your networks and coverage where you're at. So, yes, I mean, if I moved across state lines, I'm in Kansas City, and I move across state lines from Kansas to Missouri, probably not. Probably covered, or I go from D.C. to Virginia or something like that. But if I'm moving from Wyoming to Connecticut, I would probably change my insurance, or else I may be paying all out-of-network costs. So, and there's the ability to do that, where you get a special enrollment to go in and change your coverage and choose coverage. So it's the important thing here is all guarantee issue, and even with the open enrollment, there's special enrollment, so people can make the choices necessary so they won't have those gaps in coverage that they have now all too often. So.
We've got just a few minutes left, and I would ask you to pull out the evaluation form and fill it out while we're finishing. And there is someone at the microphone. Thank you, Sarah.
Good morning. I'm Lois Tett from Majority in Women-Owned Businesses. An article came up in the paper about a child being cast out of school, in fact suspended, because he was on diabetes and he had to get a certain shot or whatever. And the person that was supposed to do it was out that day. Will this insurance cover a situation where we can put more nurses, or put the nurses back into some of our public schools here in D.C.? Or is it up to the council? I guess it would be.
There is funding in the bill for school-based health care programs, and that, unfortunately, is a part of the legislation that I've not been following very closely. I don't know if anyone else here has been. I mean, certainly people with diabetes are going to be among the very big beneficiaries of the bill because they are people who often find a hard time finding affordable health insurance in the individual market at this point. But how it would address that particular problem, I don't know off the top of my head. But there is provision in the bill for school-based clinics, and I thought I saw some rules on that sometime back.
And I expect that's one of the parts of the act that was not fully appropriated in the act itself and the subject to annual appropriations, but I could be wrong. I've got a question here that's originally to be asked of Mike Hash, but actually comments about the premise of the question are just as aptly directed to our panelists here. The original question was, what is HHS's plan for the federally assisted exchanges if states resist any cooperation with HHS on any functions? And the question is, how likely is that in any state? And we have folks with good relationships with lots and good intelligence about what a whole lot of different states are planning. Anybody planning to stonewall, Krista?
Well, just give you the facts. There are there is a provision in the statute that essentially requires some cooperation, but the penalty for not cooperating is your existing federal match, which could be argued now that is coercive. So there is also a provision in the advanced planning documents that states, at least 45 states have entered into with HHS around the 90-10 match for their new eligibility systems in Medicaid that does state that there needs to be cooperation between the Medicaid program and whatever exchange is in your state, whether it's state or federal. So that's, you know, in an agreement between the state and the federal government related to that 90-10 money. So I don't know that an enforcement strategy has been outlined, but that provision is out there.
And certainly if a state decides to stonewall and say, we're not going to help the fairly facilitated exchange at all, we're not going to give them any information, that leaves them no alternative except to basically ask the companies to self-certify that they're licensed, show something from the department that says that they're solvent, and then to have the federally facilitated exchange reviewing their forms, reviewing their rates, and making sure. And that just puts the company in a tremendous bind. It's going to take a lot more time to get things up and running. You'll have a situation where the federal government will say, well, we think that rate's okay. It meets the standards. The state may say, no, it doesn't. We're not going to allow that to be sold in our state. I mean, this could cause real problems if there's no communication, no consistency, and all it's going to do is harm the companies, increase costs, and it's going to hurt consumers, too. So they're going to be confused about what's available and not available. So people understand that ramification, that result. So hopefully we won't have any that will just sit there and completely stonewall.
Yes, I had a question about undocumented immigrants and some of the states that have thus far said that they're not going to participate in the Medicaid expansion. What effect that's going to have on some of the teaching hospitals that are really dependent on the DSH payments and maintaining high ranking, getting really good residents, all of that. If they're getting any, if those governors are getting any pressure that you know of to go ahead and participate in the expansion.
Pressure, Governor?
Every hospital association in the country, which includes, I believe, almost every hospital in the country, submitted an amicus brief in the Supreme Court in support of the Medicaid expansions. Mm-hmm. And I think they all understand that they're going to be in a very tight situation if the budget cuts, the Medicare cuts go through, and in particularly the cuts of the DSH payments, and their state decides not to participate in Medicaid.
Medicaid doesn't pay all that well, but it's better to have something than nothing. And I expect the governors are hearing from their hospitals.
Thank you.
Specifically with respect to undocumented, however, the bill, of course, has nothing in it for them.
Right.
I know I have seen one estimate that the remaining uninsured population, if the ACA is fully implemented, would include maybe 25% undocumented. So there are a lot of people who will not be covered who are not undocumented immigrants, if that estimate was right. And we certainly have heard from the public hospitals and programs we have done about the potential implications of the phasing down of DSH payments. And one estimate is that Texas already receives about $1 billion a year in those payments. And with a 50 or 60% reduction over time, that's going to certainly have an impact on a lot of those hospitals.
Thank you so much.
I didn't mean to take the last word, Sarah. but we are just about at the end of our time. Thank you for hanging in there. Remind you, there will be a webcast available on the Kaiser Family Foundation website on Monday. If you turn on C-SPAN over the weekend, you might see a rerun of the live coverage of the briefing that we had today. Take this opportunity to thank the Commonwealth Fund for its co-sponsorship and support and contribution of Sarah Collins to the erudition of the panel, and ask you to help me thank the panel for a really useful discussion.
Hello, how are you?